Have you ever been in that slightly awkward, uncomfortable space? You're presenting one version of yourself, right? The composed, successful, got it all together version.
We all do it.
But deep down, you know there's a different story. You're aware of those hidden flaws, maybe mistakes you've made, or just times you didn't quite live up to your own standards.
Yeah, that tension between the image and the reality.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We all strive for integrity, don't we? But what happens when that integrity starts to feel, well, a little bit artificial?
It's a powerful question, and it cuts right to the heart of what we're digging into today. Our source material actually introduces this concept of artificial integrity.
Okay.
Think of it like living behind a facade, you know, presenting a version of yourself that masks your true thoughts or struggles or even significant errors.
Hiding things, basically.
Pretty much. It's about ignoring those internal warning signs that you're not being totally honest with yourself or others. And often the stakes are way higher than we think.
Right. So today's deep dive is into this ancient but incredibly relevant story. It's a powerful case study for confronting this artificial integrity head on.
Mm-hmm.
We're pulling insights from a sermon called You Are That Man, Confronting Artificial Integrity, which really unpacks the dramatic story of King David.
A classic, but with some fresh angles here.
Our mission isn't just to like retell an old story. It's to understand the specific pitfalls David faced, and maybe more importantly, the path he eventually took toward genuine humility, repentance, and real correction.
And to do that, we're not just looking at one place. We're drawing directly from 12 Samuel, chapters 11 and 12, obviously.
Main narrative.
Exactly. But we're adding layers from Psalm 51, which is David's response, plus bits from 1 Chronicles, Proverbs 31, even 1 Kings 15.
Wow. Okay, so a broad look.
Yeah, because these aren't just dusty old texts. They're packed with, honestly, surprising human psychology, complex motivations, and lessons about leadership, accountability, stuff that still hits home today.
For sure. So we'll explore not just what happened in this drama, but why these lessons are so relevant for you listening right now, helping you spot the signs of artificial integrity in your own life, perhaps, and navigate towards authentic truth.
Let's do it.
Okay, so let's unpack David's story. It starts with what the sermon calls a critical royal misstep.
Right.
The sermon highlights this detail right at the beginning. It says, in the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out. But David remained in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Now that seems small, but for a king back then, that was a big deal, wasn't it? A deviation.
No, absolutely. It's not a minor point at all. It's the crucial setup. What's fascinating is how the sermon connects David staying back directly to what it calls a premeditative sin.
Premeditative.
Yeah.
So not spontaneous.
That's the suggestion. The source says, and this is interesting, I don't think this was the first time David saw Bathsheba naked from his balcony. He knew of her, and he especially knew Uriah.
Oh.
So it implies maybe a previous awareness, maybe a temptation he'd already entertained, and him not being where he was supposed to be on the battlefield created the perfect storm, the opportunity for this to actually happen.
Right. So staying home wasn't just relaxing. It was like fertile ground for this temptation.
Yeah.
And things move fast from there, don't they?
Very fast.
David's on his roof, sees a woman bathing, described as very beautiful. He asks who she is, finds out it's Bathsheba, wife of Uriah the Hittite. Then he sends messengers to get her. They sleep together.
And the text even adds that detail about her purifying herself.
Yeah, which becomes relevant because soon after, she sends word back to David, I am pregnant.
Boom. Instant crisis.
Yeah.
And David's immediate reaction, it's not, oh no, what have I done? It's a desperate scramble for a cover-up.
Right, damage control.
Totally. He sends for Uriah, Bathsheba's husband, pulling him off the front lines. And the source really emphasizes, Uriah wasn't just some grunt. He was part of David's inner circle of about 35 elite fighting men.
Well, one of his best.
Exactly. Which adds this whole other layer of betrayal, doesn't it? This is a loyal, trusted warrior.
So David's first plan is kind of cunning. He brings Uriah back, tells him, go home, wash your feet, basically nudge, nudge, go sleep with your wife. So the baby looks like Uriah's.
A plausible deniability plan.
But Uriah's response, it's incredible. It completely scuppers David's plan. He says, essentially, the army's intense, Joab's in the field, the ark is out there. How can I go home and eat and drink and sleep with my wife? No way.
What integrity, right? His loyalty is to his men, to his duty, even above his own comfort. It's such a stark contrast to David at this moment.
It really highlights David's deceit, doesn't it? Uriah's principles actually expose David's lack of them.
Absolutely. And David tries again. He gets Uriah drunk the next night, hoping maybe then he'll go home.
But he doesn't.
Nope. Uriah still sleeps at the palace entrance with the servants. His principles hold even when he's drunk. This loyalty, this integrity, it actually forces David's hand. There's no easy cover-up now.
So David has to escalate, which leads to the ultimate betrayal.
It's chilling.
David writes a letter to Joab, his commander, and who delivers this death warrant?
Uriah himself, unknowingly.
The letter says, "Put Uriah out in front where the fighting is fiercest, then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die." Just cold, calculated murder.
And it happens exactly like that. Uriah dies, David gets the news, Bathsheba mourns, and then David marries her, brings her into his house, she has the son. Case closed. Not quite.
No, because the sermon hammers this point home.
Hmm.
But the thing David had done displeased the Lord. This whole sequence is the peak of David's artificial integrity. He's built this facade, living this lie, escalating from adultery to murder, thinking he's untouchable.
Or maybe just hoping nobody notices. But of course, that kind of thing rarely stays hidden forever.
Right. That artificial integrity, it's fragile. It can't hold. Which brings us to the turning point. Divine intervention. God steps in.
Yep. God sends the prophet Nathan, and Nathan's approach is, well, brilliant. He doesn't just march in and accuse the king. That could get him killed.
So how does he do it? How does he get through David's defenses?
He uses a parable, a story. He tells David, there were two men in town, one rich, one poor.
Okay, setting the scene.
The rich man has tons of sheep and cattle. The poor man has nothing except one little ewe lamb. He raised it. It ate with him, drank from his cup, slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him.
Wow, painting a picture of deep affection there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then a traveler comes to visit the rich man. And the rich man, instead of taking one of his own many animals, takes the poor man's only lamb and prepares it for his guest.
Oh, that's just awful. Blatant injustice.
Right. And David, listening as the king, the judge, he gets furious. He doesn't see the trap.
He falls right into it.
Completely. He flares up. As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity.
He's passing judgment, full of righteous anger.
Totally unaware, he's just condemned himself. The irony is staggering.
It really is. And then Nathan delivers the line, the hammer blow that shatters everything. He just looks at David and says, "You are the man."
Chills. Just wow.
Yeah.
Right. All the self-deception, the artificial integrity, it just crumbles in that moment. Nathan then spells it out directly from God's perspective. God made you king, gave you everything, saved you, yet you despised his word. You killed Uriah with the enemy's sword. You took his wife. No more hiding.
And the consequences Nathan lays out are severe, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Very direct. The sword will never depart from your house. And it gets public, too. Out of your own household, I'm brewing calamity on you. I'll take your wives before your eyes and give them to someone close to you. You did it in secret, but I will do this in broad daylight before all Israel.
A secret sin leading to public shame and disaster.
Exactly. And linking back to our theme, David was totally caught up in artificial integrity, living this huge lie. Nathan's confrontation forces a choice. Resist, double down, maybe kill Nathan, or face it, surrender.
And thankfully for David, and for the lesson here, he chooses surrender. His immediate response is so crucial. Just five words in the English translation. Then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord."
Bam. No excuses. No but. Just raw confession. That's the first absolutely vital step away from the facade. Admitting it.
And this leads directly to the first big takeaway. The sermon highlights from David's story, right?
Yes. The first lesson is, allow people to be honest with you. And this isn't just passively hearing criticism. It's about intentionally having people in your life who you allow to speak truth to you, especially, as the source puts it, when you're screwing up your life.
Creating that space for uncomfortable truth.
Exactly. It's inviting correction because you know how dangerous the blind spots are. And the proof you're really listening, it's not just nodding along. The source says the proof is action.
What kind of action?
Well, the examples given are things like actually putting down the bottle and going to AA. Or if your health is shot, actually getting into shape.
Hmm.
Or if anger is wrecking your relationships, getting professional help, action proves you heard it.
Got it. That makes sense. It's not just thanks for the feedback. It's change. Okay, what's the second lesson?
Building right on that, the second lesson is surrender in humility. David's confession was immediate, but his deep internal response, that's captured powerfully in Psalm 51, verses 1 to 9.
The famous Psalm of Repentance.
Exactly. Listen to the language. Have mercy on me, O God. blot out my transgressions, wash away all my iniquity, cleanse me from my sin. Against you, you only have I sinned.
It's incredibly raw. There's no self-justification there.
None at all. It's a total posture of surrender. Notice all those words. Mercy, iniquity, cleanse, transgression, sinful. It's a deep, gut-wrenching acknowledgement of his failure. And the sermon makes this really important point. Chosen humility is better than forced humility.
Meaning it's better to humble yourself than wait to be humbled by circumstances.
Precisely. David chose this posture. He leaned into the brokenness instead of fighting it. And that's a huge turn away from the pride that often fuels artificial integrity. It's realizing the focus isn't your image, it's your soul.
Okay, so David confesses, he humbles himself. But things don't just magically snap back to normal, do they? This leads to the third lesson, which sounds, well, tough.
It is tough, but crucial. Lesson three. Prepare for consequences after confession. Acknowledging you're wrong, even with deep humility, doesn't erase the ripples of your actions. It doesn't automatically fix the pain caused.
Right. Confession isn't a magic wand.
Not at all. And David faced years of intense suffering directly linked to what Nathan prophesied.
What kind of things?
The sermon lists them out. First, the death of the child Bathsheba carried. Just devastating. Then later, his own son, Amnon, rapes his half-sister, Tamar.
Oh, terrible.
Then another son, Absalom, murders Amnon and later tries to steal the kingdom from David, even publicly sleeping with David's concubines on the palace roof.
Exactly what Nathan predicted, in broad daylight.
Exactly. And the sermon's insight here is profound. Pain brings necessary cleansing for your soul and is an important component of the final stage in the healing process. It's not punishment for punishment's sake. It's that enduring the consequences, facing the fallout, is often where the deepest transformation happens. Confession opens the door, but walking through the consequences, that's where change gets cemented.
That's a heavy but important truth. Confession is the start, not the end, of the healing. So what's the final step in this journey, according to the sermon?
The fourth and final lesson is walk in the restoration. Even while facing those brutal consequences, David didn't just wallow. He held on to hope for restoration. We see this again in Psalm 51, verses 10 to 12.
What does he pray for there?
He asks God, "Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me." He's looking forward to rebuilding, to renewed integrity.
So it's not just about stopping the bad stuff, but actively seeking the good again.
Exactly. And what's really interesting here is the source broadens the lens to include Bathsheba. It notes Bathsheba was caught up in this as well.
Right. She wasn't just a passive observer.
No. And while we don't have like a Psalm 51 from her, the sermon suggests there are signs of her going through this process and being restored.
How so?
Okay, get this. This was a real aha moment for me in the source material. The sermon credits Bathsheba as the author of Proverbs 31.
The Proverbs 31, the virtuous woman passage.
That's the one. Think about the qualities described there. Clothed with strength and dignity, she speaks with wisdom. Her children arise and call her blessed. The implication is this describes Bathsheba after her restoration, from victim and participant in scandal to this model of strength and wisdom.
Wow, that completely reframes that passage. That's incredible.
Isn't it? But wait, there's one more piece of evidence, maybe the most powerful symbol of both David and Bathsheba's restoration.
What is it?
The name they gave their next son, the one born after the first child died.
Okay.
They named him Nathan.
No way. After the prophet, the one who called them out.
Yes. Can you imagine naming your child after the person who confronted you in your deepest sin and shame?
That's unbelievable. What a statement.
It really is. And it connects directly to the theme of restoration. The sermon puts it perfectly. You know you have been restored and not walking in artificial integrity when you embrace those who call you out. It shows they moved past defensiveness, past shame, to actual gratitude for the truth, however painful it was.
That's profound. Truly embracing the correction. And as David's life ends, there's that final summary in 1 Kings, isn't there? It's quite telling.
Yes, 1 Kings 15.5. It says, "For David had done what was right in the eyes of the Lord, and had not failed to keep any of the Lord's commands all the days of his life, except in the case of Uriah the Hittite."
That one exception, it's never erased.
Never erased. It powerfully underscores the lasting impact, the scar tissue, even after genuine restoration. But it also frames it as the exception, not the rule of his life overall. Restoration happened, but the consequences, the memory, remained.
So what a journey we've covered. From David's secret sin, that peak artificial integrity, all the way through confrontation, consequences, and finally, this deep, profound restoration.
Yeah, and those four steps the sermon outlined really provide a map, don't they? Allow honesty, surrender in humility, prepare for consequences, and walk in restoration.
They feel very practical, actually. Not easy, but clear.
And it brings us right back to where we started, thinking about our own lives. The sermon leaves us with a challenging question. Are you that man or that woman who needs to be confronted with your sin?
Oof. Direct.
Yeah. But the path David and Bathsheba show, however painful, receiving correction, accepting the fallout, choosing humility, it's presented as the way towards, quote, a beautiful life surrounded by the grace of God, a life built on real integrity, not the fake kind.
And that story about naming their son Nathan, that just sticks with me. It offers such a remarkable insight into truly embracing truth and maybe even the people who have to deliver that hard truth.
It's radical acceptance, isn't it?
It makes you wonder, doesn't it? What does it actually take for us to move beyond just deflecting or resenting criticism, especially when it's accurate, and instead feel gratitude for it? How might welcoming those tough conversations, not running from them, actually lead to, well, a deeper, more authentic, and maybe more resilient integrity in the end?
That's a really potent thought to leave things on. Moving from defensiveness to gratitude for the truth, that's a journey in itself.